Oh, right there. Right on.
All right, this is Pure Decking for October the 10th, 2013. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like descending into a police state, information security, and whatever group we're going to accuse of being the Illuminati this week. I'm Morps, and tonight we have RU, Suave, and the Madman. I am drinking the last of my Red Stag bourbon. What you guys got?
I've got Four Roses on the Rocks.
Nice.
Sounds painful.
I sadly have no alcohol tonight.
None?
None.
Are you teetotaling now?
I guess. Terrifying, isn't it?
It's starting to become a trend.
And are you, I can only assume that you're drinking, I don't know.
Yeah, Shaker's Coffee. the only brand officially chosen by Michael J. Fox.
There you go. So just as out of curiosity, did you use Red Bull instead of water when you made the coffee?
No, you used children's tears, like any good man.
Ephedrine and water.
Nice. Oh, are you? Before I forget, I got a couple of stories submitted by Cycros that I need to send to you because they were better IHN than they were. Actually, I need to send them to Suave. What am I saying?
Yeah, because I give two fucks about that show. Better off sending it to someone who cares, like the major or big.
Yeah.
Actually, give them to Epics, and Epics can relay them back.
There you go. But, yeah. He sent me some decent stories, but they were better IHM material than they were mine. So.
All right, cool. We'll run them this week, then.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. Argues Mike went a hair quiet. I'm assuming he's, you know.
I'm moving around in my chair. It's goddamn hot here, and I'm trying to avoid a Niagara-sized fall of sweat down my ass crack by the end of the show.
There you go. There you go. So, I guess getting right into it here, you know, what do websites really do with the data you send to them? So, you know, I'm talking about, you know, your Facebook, your Instagram. You were talking about one that supposedly only keeps your picture for like 20 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, 10 minutes or something like that. I'll see if I can get a name of it.
But, you know, you get thinking about it. What do these things really do with what you sent them? I mean, do you think your Facebook profile is really friends only? If nothing else, as often as they reset everything back to public? And, you know, all that targeted advertising down the side that they do, do you really think your profile is, friends only? You, your friends, and all the advertisers Facebook wants to sell it to, if you can want to get really honest about it. And we know that they're doing this because Facebook has already gotten caught and paid out, we did the story, using people's photos in ads. Apparently, if they had liked a product, Facebook would take a picture out of their photo album and use it to endorse the product.
Nice. Put a little tagline there.
And it's not just advertisers. Retailers buy that info.
Oh yeah. A lot of people buy that info. So, and it's not just Facebook. I'm just picking on them because it's easy. But if you actually go in and look, most terms of service for these kind of social networks and file sharing and whatever, they include something along the lines of an irrevocable, unlimited license of use or just a flat out transfer of ownership. And now, to be fair, their lawyers are putting that in there so that they're not going to get frivolous lawsuits or morons suing them saying, I didn't give them permission to copy my picture out to 47,000 caching server, you know, bullshit like that. But it does let them do whatever they want with it. And, I mean, you know, as somebody who's ran several websites, I understand the whole idea of, you know, you're giving us an unlimited license to use this thing just to avoid lawsuits. If I... Is that, you know, you put advertising next to my picture and that's not, you know, that kind of bullshit. So it's just a statement of protecting themselves, but it does open the door to all this kind of stuff, right?
Like list of the photo sharing websites?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just opening the door, it's how they make money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, a lot of them do.
Facebook is free for a reason. You're not the client of Facebook. You're its product.
That's very
true.
That
seems scary, dude.
No, that's absolutely
true. Is that one of their genuine mottos?
No, it's not their motto, but it's the truth. In fact, that's how most broadcast companies work. Is you're not their customer. You know, the person listening to the radio station or they're listening to the, you know, watching the TV station, you're not their customer, you're their product. Their customers are the people they're selling advertising to.
On TV, it's kind of a different, depending on whether you're watching broadcast TV, cable, or satellite.
No, the concept's the same.
Cable and satellite, you're actually a customer. You're paying for the content. They have two different customer bases.
Ah, that's a fair point, fair point.
With a broadcast, you're not the customer. You are literally the product.
Yeah. Wow. So,
well, that's my one thing I'm learning today. No more.
But now, Ari, you were talking about one that, like, supposedly only keeps your photo for 10 minutes, right?
Yeah. So, can't find the name of it. I'll ask my wife again tonight.
Don't worry about it because I'd rather not give them the free advertising.
Yeah. And essentially, they were trying to coerce her into getting images of her for her birthday. And they're like, don't worry, it's not permanent. It's only there for 10 minutes. And being half the clever person she is, she's come home and asked me, you know, do they actually delete it in 10 minutes? And I'm sort of sitting there going, probably not, because it's copied how many times before it's even seen. And yeah. Better ask Morps. Better call Saul. Better call Morps.
Yeah, Saul. I like Saul's hair. I need to get that kind of an office and hair. That's what I need.
Exactly. If you're gonna do something stupid with a computer, better call. Oops.
That's there we go. I am not a lawyer, but I aspire to play one on TV. But no. Even if you do delete a photo or a post, it really is probably not gone. And it's not even malicious. It's not like, aha, we're keeping people's stuff. A lot of times it gets put into a queue to be deleted. Like, you know, sure, they take the link off and make it look like they deleted it immediately. But most of these large websites use a caching system to load balance. They, you know, Facebook isn't running off one computer in somebody's corner, right? It's on several hundred thousand computers. And Facebook and several of the other social networks, a lot of sites use them. They've contracted Akamai. They're a CDN, a content distribution system. And Akamai actually uses geostatic IP addresses, which these things are fun to read up on. A lot of the DNS servers use the same things. Essentially, they're an IP address that when they hit your local ISP, the ISP has different computers for that IP based on where you are. So I guess the best way to explain it is the IP address is the same no matter where you are, but it gets routed differently depending on who your ISP is. So that the idea is to get to a server that's closest to you without having to rewrite the web page to figure out where you are and track you and then send you to the correct servers.
Yeah.
So the DNS servers do this. This is part of the IP spec. It's not crazy. But Akamai uses these. And so Akamai runs servers all over the place. And pretty much when you upload something to Facebook, it gets uploaded into the Akamai system, which distributes it out to thousands of servers, right? And the whole reason for doing this, you know, all these copies are made so that the post can be loaded quickly, so that it's, you know, it can... There's all kinds of reasons to do this. The big one would be that, you know, you're going to hit a server that's close to you. The other one would be if you're hitting a server that's overloaded. If you think about it, one server can only handle so many incoming connections. And a lot of these websites are huge. So what they do is they don't run just one. They run several and they cluster them up. So a copy of that post is on every one of their clusters, depending on how they set up their storage system. A lot of times it's kind of hard to really get into, but they, you know, they'll have a master storage array somewhere, a NAS kind of thing. And then they have these caching servers so that when somebody requests it, it goes into the caching server and the caching servers will hold it for, you know, half an hour, day, however long they're set up for. Yep. And then if nobody's requested that file for X amount of time, it falls out of the caches. And then the next time somebody requests it, it get cached again. I mean, it's you can go into server design all night long, But the short version of it is there's thousands of copies of whatever file you've uploaded floating around out there. Not to mention network load links. You know, if the server's not overloaded, but the network connection to it is, they'll go hit a different server. So anytime you upload something, it's copied lots and lots and lots. That's the point I'm getting at. Is it's not malicious at all. It's just the way these networks work that it's copied.
It's the way they're set up and designed. Yeah, speed and efficiency.
Exactly. So, and you know, so even if the web service is legit, the way they're architected, you know, even if they're actually deleting your file when you tell them to delete it, the way it's architected, it may not disappear for weeks, you know, fully. The other thing is that they may not delete it. They may only flag it as a removed file so that if you ever want to, you know, like if they have a recover function or an undelete function, that means it's not really gone. It's just flagged in their database. So, and again, a lot of these sites do that just for, well, headache resolution. It's like, oh, I didn't mean to delete that. Undo. Well, anytime you see an undo on any of these websites, that means they've got a backup copy. Not to mention, a lot of these, you know, any server admin worth their salt is keeping a backup of some sort. So by the time you've uploaded it, never minding their caching system, there's at least two copies of it, you know, after they've ran their backup system, and it should be a live backup for most of them. So, and if they're doing any kind of a rolling backup, I mean, depending on how long they're keeping it, they may be able to roll back to, you know, go grab the tape and pull it out, right? So, yeah. You know, again, we're kind of going overboard here on, you know, if somebody really cares that much about your pictures from a birthday party, but these things can live on like that, right?
Oh, definitely.
So, you know, even if everything on the web service is, have some system to go in and immediately remove it and, you know, everything's good. Or maybe, you know, it'll be gone within a week, some kind of a guarantee kind of thing. Or like the ones that are only supposed to keep it for 10 minutes. Yeah, they may only keep it for 10 minutes. But the web server isn't the only one that runs these caching systems. Your connection bounces through a lot of ISPs to get between you and your average web server.
Oh, hell yeah.
Your ISP is connected up usually to an upper level, you know, a higher tier ISP. The highest tier ISP is connected to a backbone. The backbone is actually just several ISPs hooked together through peering.
Comcast is going to have a copy. AT&T is going to have a copy. Then Google is going to have a copy.
There you go. Yeah, Google caches everything on a regular basis. So does archive.org, if you ever looked at their Wayback Machine. Yeah. So once it hits a web server, this thing is copied hundreds of times. And again, it's not even malicious. It's just the way the thing works. Most ISPs run caching proxies. They do this to store web content as it's requested. And so for a while after the original content's requested, the cache copy is sent instead of calling back out to the web server. As a good example, how many people, you know, they have Google set as their homepage, right? Or what's the Microsoft Bing? No.
Yeah, it's Bing.
But that's not the page that Internet Explorer defaults to. Nah, I can't remember.
Let me click on Internet Explorer.
You haven't changed it, I'm sure. So, yeah, it's MSN or whatever the Internet Explorer default page is.
MSN.
MSN.com.
Okay, yep. Cool. I'm surprised I even remembered that. But if you think about it, does your ISP, we'll just use the Google logo because a lot of people pull that up. How many times would your ISP need to go out to Google's web server and pull down that image for every time somebody, one of their customers, clicks on it, right? So instead, they run what's called a caching proxy. And, you know, it might be set to keep, you know, they're variable. You can set it to keep it for however long you want. Most people keep, you know, pick a reasonable amount of time, you know, a couple hours. Some of them are set to keep it for a day, you know, whatever. So you request that Google image because you open the web page. Well, that caching proxy is going to request it. And that way, for the next hour, however long that server's configured for, every time somebody requests that image, they're going to go get the copy from the caching proxy because one's a hell of a lot faster because they don't have to go back out to Google servers to get it, even though the Google servers are actually fairly quick. But, you know, two, how much bandwidth are they saving by, you know, hitting a local server up at the ISP as opposed to going all the way back out to Google servers, wherever their local closest data center is. So But these caches can live on. Some of them are set for quite a long period of time because the longer that cache is set, the more bandwidth they save. So yeah, it's not even malicious. It's just the way these things are set up for access and speed. And then you get into the stuff that is malicious. You know, anybody watching an unencrypted wire can save the files as they go across. You ever want to have some fun with that? There's a tool called Network Miner. Great little tool. I actually use it at work a lot when I'm looking for oddball connections and stuff. But if you play with Network Miner, they're saying the IRC DriftNet, same tool. Yeah, it just caches files as it goes across the wire. And, you know, how many people are probably running that on an ISP line? Like, hell, I know if I had access to an ISP, a major ISP's line, I would probably have a copy of something like that running just for the fun of it, just to see what all went across, not because you even care where it's coming from. Just, you know, it's just interesting to see it for a little while. So,
it's like reading people's email, Morps.
It is.
You think it's going to be interesting, but how many people live interesting lives or send interesting emails?
Well, I don't know, man.
I'm going with the bulk of it's going to be boring and crap. I mean, how many porn requests do you really want to see in 45 minutes?
You would be surprised.
Google what is incest porn in German.
Well, that was because I didn't know what that file was on a server. And when you're dealing with a rooted server, you have to see what something is. And it's just, yeah, it's like, you know, you're looking at the German and it's like, I'm afraid that might be, let's just, yep, that is. Fuck.
But it's reading other people's stuff and getting into their networks. It's not about the content. Most of it's about the journey. And then when you get there, sometimes it's surprising.
I did have access to run something like that for a little while, and you're right, it does get kind of boring. But it is interesting seeing all the image files go across until the hard drive fills up. So,
would you really count the architecture part of that as something Facebook is doing with your info? Because that's not really them consciously doing something, that's just the network working.
No, but it does mean that file is still floating around, so if somebody really wanted it, it's still floating around. I mean, you're right that all this architecture stuff is not malicious. It's not them intentionally going, we're going to keep 1,000 extra copies. Ha ha. No, it's not that.
Well, generally when I think of what are they doing with my info, I do think of all the people they're selling it to, or in some cases giving it to. The government keeps track of all that just for profiling everyone.
Well, you know, talk about running DriftNet on an ISP. Hello, NSA. I mean, so you're right. I mean, the encryption helps, like if you're running SSL, but, you know, anybody who viewed it's also going to have local copies on their machines. So, not to mention, like Madman just said, the server still has the unencrypted copy, and they can sell it, and a lot of them do.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Like, hi, this guy said he likes Domino's. Let's sell him some ads.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. So, it's just, you know, if you want to have some fun, you know, once content gets out, it's really hard to force it to go away. Those Beyonce pictures, for example, they just keep coming
everyone,
back.
Everyone followed what she said and deleted it.
Yeah, sure.
That's, same as that, no one used the image of Barack Obama with the shotgun in any malicious way.
I've got to Google that now.
You haven't seen the... Oh, it's a hilarious picture.
Oh, man, you got to check it out.
Oh, it's great. There's all kinds of things wrong with that picture.
The Trayvon Martin one is the funniest one.
You know, I mean, it's the same thing like your average photocopier station. They have hard drives in them.
Yeah.
And they save images that goes across all everything somewhere on that hard drive for a little while. I mean, granted, it deletes stuff as it gets full, but it's still there. So, you know, and that's not even intent. You know, Madman's absolutely right. That's not even intent. That's just architecture. But it's helpful to know that all that's there, because even if the service is on the up and up, looking at just how this stuff works, you realize how many copies of whatever you're uploading are made. And then if the service isn't on the up and up, if they're like Facebook and selling everything to everyone, then, you know, even more to know. That's more on the individual service. You have to look at the service and see what are they doing. you know, actually skim the terms of service and see what they, you know, say they can do with your data.
Pretty much everything that you're not paying for, they're selling your data. That's how they're financing it. So if you have a free email account, they're selling whatever you're looking at.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. What's your fan there, Madman?
I found Obama with a shotgun. Obama with a golf club holding it like it's a shotgun. I'm seeing Star Wars kid Obama style with just different things you can do with a shotgun or that pose.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyways, you know, even if the service is on the up and up, you just got to look at how the internet works and realize how many copies of whatever it is you're posting go up there. So, the short answer is if you've got photos you don't want getting out, Don't post them. Just don't, you know, don't keep them somewhere where they're gonna get posted. Madman, you got a fan pointed at your microphone, dude. If you know, if it's something you want to share with people, there are ways to do it that don't involve posting it on Facebook and trusting Facebook to keep it.
Yep.
The easiest one to do, quite honestly, is just to mail them a flash drive. You know, SD cards are cheap. Copy them onto the SD card, mail it. Now, granted, that sucks and it's slow, but if you've got the incriminating pictures of you holding the cocaine and flashing the money, you know, smacking the hooker's ass, and you really got to share this with your buddies, that's probably not the best thing to put on Facebook, where your boss is going to see it.
That's how I go.
But it's private. The cops are never going to see that. I clicked private.
Yeah.
They
yeah,
need that's a warrant, right?
I don't know. You could take the complete inverse of that and throw them up on 4chan. That way nobody would care. It's like, get there.
That's how I should get all
minutes.
My photos back from the States. Boxes holding on to them. I should just get him to put them on a thumb drive and all the video and send it.
That would probably be the easiest thing to do. The other thing you could do, I mean, the only other way to trust a server is to run it yourself and use encryption and just understand that as this thing goes through ISPs, it's, you know, stuff potentially could get copied. So that's where the encryption comes in. I mean, if you've got stuff you're very paranoid about and you really want to transfer and not risk anybody getting and you're willing to do the work, you set up your own server somewhere. You wrap everything up in a TrueCrypt volume or a passworded archive of some sort, one that actually uses encryption and not just a password on the unarchiving, and just wrap it up and put it on the server. And when they tell you they've got it, remove it from the server. You know, a good passworded service of some sort. Now, there's other programs out there. I know, Suave, we were playing around with RetroShare. That seemed like that might be, yeah, that's a direct peer-to-peer connection. Something like that might work. But, you know, again, that's RetroShare is kind of hard to explain to grandma. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's also, you just got to consider the fact, it's just like we were talking about earlier, watching the ISP line. It's like, oh, it's pictures of somebody at a birthday party. Who fucking cares? I mean. So there is just the appropriate level of what to share and what not to share. You know, if you're at the birthday party and drunk and, you know, I don't know, trying to make out with somebody, yeah, posting that one on Facebook for your wife to see might not be the best of ideas. But, you know, if it's just, just use some judgment before you post your photos, and the whole 10-minute share one, I wouldn't trust it to disappear after 10 minutes. They're asking in the IRC why you'd be emailing pictures of cocaine and dead hookers to grandma. Well, you've never met my grandmother.
It's surprising how hard it was to come up with a photo compilation for some of the people I know that have died recently because everything had something illegal in it.
Oh.
That's funny and sad at the same time.
It's like, do you really want a bunch of priests seeing this?
Actually, are you've got a good thing there. There was a teacher who got in trouble for posting a photo of herself on Facebook holding a glass of wine But because she was like an elementary school teacher or something, she got fired.
Yeah. So that's a little bit more broader explanation why the question was asked and why, not because you're that paranoid, man. It just, as you're ascending in your career, you don't sort of want pictures like that getting out there. Right? Well, you want to betray the sensible, you know, I do everything right, even on my days off. Look.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why
the fake Facebook pages are becoming popular.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
One that's completely public, that everyone that you're applying for sees, and you're always wearing a suit with 1,000 degrees in the back, degrees framed in your background. Possibly, I don't know, handshaking the president with the president and stacks of gold bars behind you, whatever.
Stacks of gold bars would think that you're unmotivated for the job because you've got enough money as it is.
Yeah.
I was thinking that would convey success in life.
I guess that would depend on who you're trying to, you know, who your prospective employer is.
Yeah. But,
and then you have like your, you know, the actual real stuff that goes up on like Diaspora or whatever. So, ooh, that's one I haven't seen in a while. Swalve, were you following Diaspora? Diaspora? Am I saying that wrong?
No, I haven't actually.
The open source Facebook clone.
Yeah, I have no idea whatever happened to that. It probably never took off because you need a huge influx of people for any social network to be successful. That always seemed like a fringe thing.
That one was cool because you could run your own and then have it sync up to other networks. So, but I mean, yeah, you know, the whole private retro share network is where you put the pictures of the party with the, you know, with the hookers and the hard booze and the, you know, it's like, here's, you know, here I am taking shots of absinthe. I mean,
here I am doing a line of cocaine off a Mexican hooker's ass.
We're not gonna ask why Mexicans.
We're not going to ask why you were doing cocaine off that Mexican guy, madman, but, you know. All right. I mean,
wondering
we
why we can't get some sort of other minority to the party. It's always Mexicans.
They're cheap. You know how much a good Asian hooker costs? It seems they realize that there's a demand for them in the States, and they raise the prices. Mexicans are like a dime a dozen. Literally, you can buy a dozen of them for a dime, have four of them mow your lawn, some of them do the dishes, and one give you head.
Just make sure you pick the right one for each job.
How is America in debt? Oh, spending all the money on hookers and blower.
All right, let's let's go on to stories here, because this is
devolving quickly.
It's been there for a while. What are you talking about? So first one I have up is from kluven.be, and this is a pretty interesting article here, actually. Device fingerprinting, also known as browser fingerprinting, is the practice of collecting properties of PCs, smartphones, and tablets to identify and track users. These properties include the screen size, the versions of installed software and plugins, and the list of installed fonts. A 2010 study by the Electronic Frontier Foundation showed that the vast majority of browsers, the combination of these properties is unique and thus functions as a fingerprint that can be used to track users without relying on cookies. Actually, I'll bet that installed fonts one really does help, because fonts is always something that's oddball whether they'll be the same from machine to machine. Device fingerprinting targets either Flash, the ubiquitous browser plugin for playing animations, videos, and sound files, or JavaScript, common programming language for web applications. The first comprehensive effort to measure the prevalence of device fingerprinting on the internet, or this is the first comprehensive effort to measure the prevalence of device fingerprinting on the internet. The team of KU Leuven iMinds researchers analyzed the internet's top 10,000 websites, so I guess we weren't in that list, and discovered that 145 of them use Flash-based fingerprinting. Some Flash objects include questionable techniques, such as revealing a user's original IP address when revisiting a website through a third party. The study also found that 404 of the top 1 million sites use JavaScript-based fingerprinting, which allows sites to track non-Flash mobile phones and devices. The fingerprinting scripts were found to be probing a long list of fonts, sometimes up to 500, by measuring the widths and heights of secretly printed strings on the page. Oh, damn. So they've got all these different tags on the page full of strings that are just not visible to see if the font's installed or not. The researchers identified a total of 16 new providers of device fingerprinting, only one of which had been identified in prior research. And another surprising finding, the researchers found that users are tracked by these device fingerprinting technologies, even if they explicitly request not to be tracked by enabling the Do Not Track HTTP header. The researchers are also evaluating Tor Browser and Fire Gloves, two privacy-enhancing tools offering fingerprinting resistance, new vulnerabilities, some of which give access to users to identity, were identified. So, not so much. Device fingerprinting can be used for various security-related tasks, including fraud detection, protection against account hijacking, and anti-bot and anti-scraping services. But it's also being used for analytics and marketing purposes via fingerprinting scripts hidden in advertising banners and web widgets. To detect websites using device fingerprinting technologies, the researchers developed a tool called FP Detective. The tool crawls and analyzes websites for suspicious scripts, and the tool is freely available. So if you go to this story in the show notes when I post it, you'll be able to actually download the tool for other researchers to use and build upon. The findings were presented at the 20th AMC Conference on Computer and Communication Security this November in Berlin. So the whole thing the EFF was on about, the whole browser fingerprinting thing they were on about, websites are using that now.
So
awesome.
I just came up with a gold mine for paranoid people. We have to write a program that just spoofs some of that information every time you switch servers. It just changes one or two of those things they're searching for, so it looks like a different computer is hopping from server to server.
I just suggest everybody use virtual machines, because if everyone's using, you know, a Ubuntu live CD or even a Tails live CD in a virtual machine where the screen size is set to, you know, 1024, 768, or I don't know, pick a resolution we're all standardized on. That way everyone's browser looks exactly the same. And you could do that with a Linux live CD and a VM, because the screen size would be the same, the fonts would be the same, the operating system and the plugins would all be the same. The only thing is, getting everybody to do that would be damned hard.
True.
All right, I guess next story is from Ars Technica. Early last year, password security researchers researcher Kevin Young was hitting a brick wall. Over the previous few weeks, he made steady progress decoding cryptographically protected password data leaked from the then recent hack of the intelligence firm Stratfor. With about 60% of the more than 8,600,000 passwords hashes cracked, his attempts to decipher the remaining 40% were failing. The so-called dictionary attacks he mounted using lists of more than 20 million passwords culled from previous website hacks had worked well. Augmented with programming rules that substituted letters for numbers or combined two or more words on his lists, his attacks revealed Stratfor's passwords such as Pinky and the Brain. It's a couple others here. Brute force techniques tried every possible combination of letter, number, and special characters, also succeeded at cracking all passwords of 8 or fewer characters. So the remaining 344,000 passwords, Young concluded, must be longer words or phrases cracked or few crackers had seen before. I was starting to run out of word lists, he recalled. I was at a loss for words, literally. He cracked the first 60% of the lists using the freely available Hashcat and John the Ripper password cracking programs, which ran guesses through the same MD5 algorithm Stratfor and many other sites used to generate the one-way hashes. I'm going to skip ahead a bit here because this article is long, and the gist of it is they figured out that passphrases aren't as secure as they're made out to be, because for a passphrase to be memorable, how do I summarize this? They figured out that most people were using quotes, you know, from a book or the Bible or a YouTube video or, you know, Wikipedia. And so they would, you know, people would have very, very strong passwords, but because it was a common line of like a line from the Call of Cthulhu game, or, you know, even one of the Lovecraft books, yeah, it was readily available on YouTube as a common quote. Or not YouTube, they were pulling stuff off Wikipedia to put together the passphrase lists. And this was like crazy effective, because everybody using passphrases is using a common phrase that they can remember. Because everybody says over a passphrase, because once you get over 60 characters, you don't have to worry about the special characters and the numbers so much. So people are just using these long passwords that are like full sentences. But because these things are, you know, rememberable, they're easy to guess. So
stay away from anything pop culture-ish.
Yeah.
Or
well,
just
replace
the spaces with special symbols.
Or even just like replace the first letter with the special symbol or something like that. Like,
oh yeah. Let me read the last couple of paragraphs here because these are awesome. On militarysingles.com, people use passwords like "hooah," Dustin explained. That's not a real word that'll be in your dictionary, but by supplying the words Marines and Navy, you're going to end up with words like "hooah" in your list. With Twitter, it lets you target specific password users. More recently, Dustin has turned his attention to YouTube for the same reasons. He says, I like YouTube comments because you have current garbage, stuff the way people say it, slang, misspellings, and things like that. That's the way people do their passwords quite often. So you'll find a lot of slang that doesn't end up in a dictionary, even on Wikipedia or a book. So they're scraping YouTube comments to build password and passphrase lists.
One for any password-inspired snoop out there. Phonetic Dictionary. Yep. That's another great one.
All right, let's move on to a story that you guys are going to fucking love. It's from RT. Authorities have partially blamed gadget-absorbed commuters for failing to notice a gun-wielding assailant who calmly took his time before shooting a man point-blank on a San Francisco train. This man, 30-year-old Nick Holm Thercoplasium? I don't know how to say that. Thercoplasium? Flashed his .45 caliber pistol several times in front of everyone before proceeding to shoot San Francisco State University student Justin Valdez, 20, in the back of the head before leaving the train. Police believe the attack to have been completely unprovoked, so crazy person with a gun. The September 23rd incident, as reported by the San Francisco Chronicle, involved security footage showing the Pelisclayon pulling out the gun, raising and pointing it, even wiping his nose with the sleeve of his hand before tucking the weapon away and drawing it again several more times before with nobody the wiser. He then simply shot Valdez and disembarked. So it's like he noticed nobody was panicking because he pulled a gun, so he just shot somebody. This incident highlights an increasing lack of attention from passers-by, authorities say, alluded to the spread of high-tech toys. People are so engulfed in their handheld entertainment devices that they pay almost zero attention to their surroundings. District Attorney George Gasson believes technology has greatly hindered people's ability to concentrate, leading to increased crime as well as theft. These weren't concealed movements. The gun is very clear, he told the Chronicle. They're just so engorged texting and reading and whatnot that they're completely oblivious to their surroundings. Following a speedy arrest, several charges were levied at the Plesclaum, including murder and assault with a semi-automatic handgun. He pleaded not guilty.
Find a witness. I dare you.
Despite this lack of admission, the police have discovered small weapons arsenal after carrying out a search of his apartment. The weapons included the two assault rifles and multiple combat knives, adding illegal possession of assault weapons to the charges. So this story is as much anti-gun as it is people, you know, getting on people for not, well. Subsequent investigation revealed that Valdez was almost the second victim that night. Had stuck a gun on another man's back just hours before as he looked for somebody to shoot. He did not pull the trigger, choosing to go hunt for another hour. He then wound up in front of a Thai restaurant where he again waved and played around with his gun. You don't do that, God.
So this guy walked around for hours, like pointing his gun at people and like playing around with it, and nothing happened.
Yeah, I mean,
where was this again?
San Francisco. He was arrested with $20,000 in cash on his person.
Oh, wow.
You think about it, man. It's first thing on a Monday morning, going to work. You're just reading the paper. You see a dude pull a gun. Nope, I'm going back to the paper. Fuck this. I ain't getting involved, man.
I'm betting there's as much of that as it is.
That's how that went down, man. Because yeah. no one wanted to get involved. Because you'll bet, I'll bet even money, both men that were shot were of darker complexion or not of the Caucasian persuasion. And everyone just went, drug deal gone wrong. Don't care.
I don't know. What was the guy's name? He was a student.
The first guy was Hispanic.
Justin yeah. Valdez. So, yeah, probably Hispanic.
But, yeah, people are just unwilling to get involved. It's not that no one noticed. This is, like, not my problem. I get too much other shit going on. I do not want to get involved.
It's, oh, that's a gun.
I don't know how much of it was people not wanting to get involved, because this story actually made the news. There's surveillance camera footage of people just not noticing this guy.
Wow.
I mean, I love that. Everybody's, like, so engorged in texting and playing games on their phones, they don't notice somebody pulling a gun and shooting someone. I mean, that's just fantastic.
Well, they noticed after the gun was fired, because I don't care how engrossed you are, guns are loud.
Well, except for the, you know, a couple of those guys with those big-ass Beats headphones, you know?
Yeah, the noise-canceling ones.
Those might have still been oblivious, right up to the blood splatter.
Hey, man, I can't see my screen.
That's horrible. Great, now I'm going to get the wipes out and clean this.
Wow. All right. Next one up is from Ars Technica. The National Security Agency has a wide-ranging menu of software exploits at its disposal to tailor for the right attack for the targets. The targets it wants to monitor, according to a blog post published Wednesday by security expert Bruce Schneier. While the program allows analysts to operate in almost absolute secrecy, the NSA's pursuit of an expansive surveillance program has largely defeated those efforts, he said, or his essay concludes. As last week's publication of secret NSA documents showed, the agency's operatives servers, damn it, the agency operates servers codenamed Fox Acid that exploit software vulnerabilities on targets' computers. By the time those attacks are unleashed, analysts have already know a huge amount about the person on the receiving end. Based on that information, the spies will use a complicated trade-off system to automatically choose an attack from a multi-layered menu of options. If the target is a high value one, Fox Acid might run a rare 0-day exploit that it developed or purchased, Schneier wrote. If the target is technically sophisticated, Fox Acid might determine that there's too much chance for discovery, and keeping the 0-day exploit a secret is more important. If the target is a low value one, Fox Acid might run an exploit that's less valuable. If the target is low value and technically sophisticated, Fox Acid might even run a already known vulnerability. The cost-benefit analysis also includes a detailed flowchart showing when to stop a successful attack. Those scenarios include something, you know, when something stops working as expected, when a personal security product is detected, or anything goes weird. I like how that's in quotes. Anything goes weird. As somebody who's done pen testing, that is actually a technical term. The goal is to ensure that the exploits will always go undetected. Schneier goes on to contrast the operational secrecy with the policy of brazen surveillance that has been portrayed more than three months on the front pages of newspapers and websites throughout the world. While the NSA excels at performing in this cost-benefit analysis at the tactical level, it's far less competent at doing the same thing at a policy level, wrote Schneier, who analyzed technical documents the former NSA contractor Snowden put out to The Guardian. Yeah, okay, we're done. Yeah, I mean, it's a Snowden story, but basically, I love the cost-benefit analysis of, you know, determining whether it's more important to keep the 0-day a secret or to risk exposing it and go after the target. Because that's the same thing you see, well, the underground guys doing.
Yeah,
that's the good way of doing things.
Absolutely. You don't want to reveal your O-day. If you're not using your O-Day in attacks, the only chance of somebody else finding it is somebody else actually doing the exploit work and developing it again. And truthfully, it's kind of rare that you see that. I mean, it happens, but generally what happens is an exploit is developed and they start throwing it around the wild and it gets redeveloped by people trying to reverse engineer how the attack's working. So if the attack's not going on, the chance of somebody else stumbling across it's actually pretty low. So, yeah.
Pretty.
And there's enough stuff floating around out there that there's a good chance that exploit's going to not be found because there's so much other stuff to find. Sorry, Swamp, I didn't mean to step on you.
No, no, I was just going to say, you know, this almost just sounds like it's like super hacking for dummies. You know, it sounds like they've got the software suite where it's really just like click this button, then click this button, follow this chart, okay, then click this button, and now you've hacked and like owned your enemy's box.
If the exploits are that reliable, though, that's what you want.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Script kiddie work. I think a lot of NSA operatives are pretty much just that.
Oh, absolutely. They're buying their exploits. They've probably got a team developing it, but I'm sure the people using them and the people developing are different teams, because you're absolutely right that it is kind of script kiddie-ish, but, you know,
If it works, it works.
If that's the point. If you can develop your exploit to the point where it's reliable enough to be script kiddie-ish, that's actually really fucking cool. Because that's hard to get them that reliable. You know, if you go digging through Metasploit to see what kind of exploits are in there, you're going to see a lot of them that say this crashes the service. This, you know, may not work. This, you know, I mean, there's several of them that are quite reliable. Of course, you know, the classic MS-0867, that one's going to get your shell almost every time. But a lot of them in there, especially ones that exploit, like, say, a web service or a media service, they're going to crash out the service that you're exploiting. So you might get a shell, but somebody's going to notice their server ain't working. So, you know, it's real interesting to me that they've developed this full, you know, AcidFox system that... Oh, wait, I said that backwards. Fox Acid. That actually ranks whether or not, you know, what attacks they should actually throw at the system. But other than that, that's classic profiling. I mean, that's absolutely the groundwork you have to do if you're going to go pop a box. You find out who's running it. You find out as much as you can without, you know, touching the box, preferably. And that way, when you throw in it, if you're doing the job right, and this is, you know, white hat, if you're doing pen testing, you really shouldn't be throwing exploits around willy-nilly. You know, the whole auto-pwn bullshit that you'll see in a lot of these scripts and tools, you don't want to throw that because it just starts throwing everything and everything it can at a box, and you're likely to crash it. You know, you might get six shells back, but then the whole thing's going to go down and somebody's going to know what's up. So really, if you're doing the job correctly, you should never throw an exploit until you know, unless you're absolutely certain it's going to work. Because if it doesn't work, you could still potentially crash out of service. You could reveal, if somebody's actually watching their logs, you could reveal yourself. You know, you'd have to burn that IP address and get another one. There's all kinds of... It's just dirty to throw an exploit and see if it works. You know, you do that in a VM in the lab. You never do that with a live target. Unless, of course, you know, you're not being paid, you're black hat, and you're just seeing if it works on somebody else's box because it's easier. But, I mean, that's different. That's not the professional way to do it. that's the script kiddie way to do it. So, let's see. Next one up. This one is pcpro.co.uk. Microsoft has admitted Windows users should install antivirus above and beyond its own security essentials, describing its protection as merely a baseline that will always be on the bottom of antivirus software rankings. Microsoft launched Security Essentials in 2009, raising complaints from antivirus rivals that such software shouldn't be bundled with Windows for competition reasons. However, the most frequent complaint about Security Essentials is that it's not good enough. It flunked a pair of tests earlier this year, including one from Dennis Technology Labs, a testing firm affiliated with PC Pro's publisher. Now, Microsoft has said it sees Security Essentials as merely the first layer of protection, advising customers to use additional third-party antivirus, although the company stressed that it wasn't because the product wasn't good enough to stand on its own. Holly Stewart, a senior program manager for the Microsoft Malware Protection Center, told Dennis Technology Labs that Microsoft made a decision to switch to what it calls a baseline strategy. We had an epiphany a few years ago back in 2011, where we realized that we had a greater calling, and that was to protect all Microsoft customers, she said. But you can't do that with a monoculture, and you can't do that with malware-catching ecosystem that is not robust and diverse. Rather than focusing on making its own antivirus the best in the business, Stewart said that Microsoft was doing everything we can to protect against real threats and passing data on those threats to antivirus makers, so multiple parties can target the problems. It's not as effective to have one kind of weapon, she said. Like anything, you must have that diversity. It's a weakness to have just one. Previously, Microsoft would spend more resources trying to improve Security Essentials' performance in the tests. We used to have part of our team dedicated towards predicting test results and figuring out what they might be in someone's test. There's always a cost to that. If we're doing that work, then we're not looking at those threats that are affecting our customers. We always felt that it was wrong. There's something not right about that, and we're not doing the best job for our customers. The company decided to stop that practice and put its efforts elsewhere. We put half those people on focusing on what we can do to prevent threats. We developed this new telemetry to look for emerging threats, sort of an early notification system that new threats were emerging. And we had this group of folks that start focusing on threats that we saw and increased our protection service. I'm going to start summarizing here because this article keeps going. Pretty much, the Microsoft team in charge of Security Essentials, it says they don't really care about the tests and the benchmarks anymore, that instead they're going to go for baseline, and that it's probably prudent to install a different antivirus.
Imagine Trojan Condom saying that.
Yeah.
Well, we're just considering this the baseline of protection.
Multiple antiviruses generally fight each other on a machine. Yeah. So they're saying don't use their antivirus.
Yeah, pretty much.
To me, this is basically Microsoft saying, we screwed up. We can't make a good antivirus. And here's a bunch of corporate speak to make it sound like we didn't screw up, but we did.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, too. So, and I'm not happy about finding that article because, well, I've been using that one for a while because it's free and it's light on a system. But, so their focus is not on being a good antivirus, but instead providing a baseline. That's not a...
But as I pointed out, you can't have multiple antiviruses on a system. I've tried this before completely by accident.
Yeah, it slows the system way the hell down, doesn't it, Madman?
If there's five of them, it just stops booting.
Well, now, I remember fixing that a system for you when you had, like, three of them on there. When did you get to five?
You didn't actually scroll through all of those pages when I hit install all on that probably owned piece of software. The last two pages were antiviruses. I was only looking at the look at all this stuff for pirating. I meant for archiving DVDs and things that you find on the internet.
Oh, I remember that SKU of Windows. Yeah, that one was hilarious.
Oh yeah,
all that shit it came with.
And the way we fixed it was, I just reinstalled and actually read everything this time and selected one antivirus instead of install all, where you shouldn't have an install all option when you are bundling six or seven different antiviruses. Yeah.
Readings for dummies.
So, I still get that problem at work a lot because we have a lot of people who, go through the hoops to download and install like AVG and Avast and a few other things on top of the Symantec that comes on the system we give them. So that's always fun.
Like, the reason your machine is crap is you have five different antiviruses.
The reason your machine is crap is because you're an idiot.
Like, an antivirus is a virus. Just letting you know that.
So, yeah, it's interesting to see them. They're saying they're refocusing and they expect to lose most of the tests from now on. So I think, you know what that almost sounds like to me? It's like McAfee and Symantec got together and it's like, Microsoft, we're just going to pay you to back off.
And that must have been
what happened. If that meeting happened.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised in the least.
Because you're getting rid of a competitor that people are going to trust. I trust Microsoft. That's why I kind of run their OS. That and all the video games I want to play work on Microsoft, work on Windows.
I do not trust Microsoft, but, you know, when you got to pick the lesser of evils. So, Anyways, I mean, but, you know, they're a, the Security Essentials AV for a long time was considered really good. So I just, it's surprising to see Microsoft saying, yeah, we're backing off. So next one up is from the Atlantic Wire and is hilarious. In a meeting with telecommunications representatives on Wednesday, NSA head Keith Alexander asked for some help defending the agency against several months of reports detailing the extent of the agency's data collection programs. Those reports, based on leaks from the NSA contractor Edward Snowden, have impacted the foundation of trust that the industry has with the NSA and that the NSA has with the American people, he said, adding that the leaks could hurt his initiative to start even more information sharing between private companies and U.S. intelligence. Of course, there's a pretty big reason that Snowden leaks have impacted that foundation of trust. They revealed to the extent of U.S. intelligence access to daily communications. And while Alexander has often defended the programs against criticism by arguing that the agency is only interested in a much smaller amount of data than it's capable of collecting.
Oh, God. Did that article just say it's good because they could spy on us even more?
Yeah, pretty much. The leaks have also revealed substantial oversight issues in ensuring that the agency does what it says it does. That's not to mention the so-called Love Int, or the otherwise known nickname for the international instances of spies spying on their loved ones. According to Washington Post, along with The Guardian and a few other outlets of the Snowden leaks, Alexander made the following pitch to telecommunication industry reps. Alexander added, did it not copy? Doesn't look like it copied. Interesting. Alexander added that he has been particularly troubled by reporting that he saw extremes, or describes as the extremes of what government could do with data rather than focusing on how the government was using the data. We need to put the facts on the table. We need the American people to understand the facts, and it's going to start with what we're actually doing, not what we could be doing with the data. And so somebody who just completely doesn't understand why everybody's pissed.
Well, here's a fact. We're protected against unreasonable search and seizure. One of the things that's unreasonable is if you're spying on everyone without cause.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, and completely not getting it. In September, Alexander blamed the media again, this time arguing that the recent push in Congress for some sort of NSA reform was due to sensationalized reports on the subject. So pretty much the NSA is going to the media and being like, No, this isn't because of anything we're doing. It's because you guys are mean. You guys are blowing this way out of proportion, man. Quit it.
This tells me that not only are they corrupt, but they're stupid.
I mean, and Madman wins the prize.
If you want to try to cover this up, you don't go to, I don't know, any media mogul and say, hey, guys, help us with a PR campaign. You show up with a suitcase full of money and then all the information you have on them. And this is a two-pronged approach. You start with the carrot. You try to bribe them. And if you find someone who, I don't know, won't take a bribe, which may be a miracle, you then pull out all that nice spying stuff that you've done.
I'll take a bribe.
Finding them with a mistress or, I don't know, faking information because you can just produce random photos of them touching children and then saying this will also hit the news if you don't help us out.
They're the blackmail route.
Yeah, that's the way you solve this problem from the NSA's point of view.
I don't know. Madman's willing to Photoshop people touching children. I'm remind me never to cross him. Damn.
You start out, like I said, start out with the carrot. You bribe them. And then if that doesn't work, you put them on different lists and make their lives hell until they do what you want.
Yeah.
So, Morps, next time Madman comes around with a big wad of cash, take the cash.
Absolutely.
But I love the... It just shows that they're stupid when they're going with, guys, we need a PR campaign to make us look like we're not spying on everyone, because apparently that pisses them off.
Yeah,
I've lost even more respect for the NSA.
I just loved the whole headline of the NSA wants the media to quit pointing out what they're doing.
So they go to the media to tell the media to stop the media from pointing out what they're doing in the media.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right.
No wonder they thought they could get away with this forever. They're fucking retarded.
Like, you know that First Amendment? Can you ignore that it exists and stop reporting on what we're doing?
Oh, yeah. By the way, just don't report that we've asked you to stop doing that, because it would be mighty embarrassing.
Would you like a suitcase full of money to stop reporting on us?
We have photos of you.
Touching children. If the suitcase of money doesn't work.
Oh, damn.
At See, some that's point, don't the you way just this should have worked. People?
I mean,
we haven't quite gone full Banana Republic. We're, I don't know, artificial Banana Republic at this point. God. When anyone from Chiquita runs for office, then they start shooting people.
All right, last story here. This one's from Ars Technica. Bitcoin enthusiasts appear to have located the wallet number of the federally collected account that now contains over 3.5 million worth of the digital currency. That money is believed to have come from the seized accounts of the Silk Road website. All Bitcoin transactions are public, and unless an account holder comes forward to say that they own a particular wallet, it's almost impossible to know with complete certainty who actually controls it. A court document from earlier this week states that the United States claims the right to seize the Silk Road's assets. As the protective order states, the United States is further authorized to seize any and all Bitcoins contained in wallet files residing on Silk Road servers, including those servers enumerated in the caption of this complaint, pending the outcome of the civil proceeding, by transferring in full the account balance in each Silk Road wallet to a public Bitcoin address controlled by the United States. Some users of the Blockchain Info, a website that provides graphical user interface for managing Bitcoin's entire public ledger, have already dubbed this wallet Silk Road Seized Coins, and adding a name to a field in the upper left of the webpage that ordinarily says Bitcoin address. As of this writing, the account holds 27,365.877449559 BTC. Kelly Lagmaster, an FBI spokesperson, told Ors on Thursday that the agency had seized more than 26,000 estimated between 3.8 to 4 million Bitcoin as part of the Silk Road case. She also noted that this was the first ever seizure of Bitcoins by the FBI. Several people have even donated additional tiny amounts of money to the account, seemingly as a way to convey a message to federal authorities in the public field of the transaction.
That's stupid.
So, isn't this great? Some of the public notes that people have been, you know, giving somebody like 0.00001 of a Bitcoin to tell the FBI. I thought of sniffing farts while sending these Bitcoins to you. Public note. Hey, computer geek who controlled this address. Ross Ulbricht is not the bad guy. You are a bad guy. Please open your eyes. However, Lagmaster wrote to Ars on Friday stating that she was not able to confirm that this public particular address had drawn so much attention on the Blockchain Info was a federally controlled Bitcoin wallet. We are not confirming one account or another, she said. Roger Verse, a spokesperson for Blockchain Info, told Ars that there was a strong correlation but no proof of causality. The reported amount the FBI stole from the Silk Road matches the approximate time and amount held in that address, he added. So that right there tells you something. He used the word stole, not seized. The first transaction of that amount was 47 different wallets transferred a total of 1,000 Bitcoins on October 2nd, 2013 at 10:12 Greenwich Mean Time. So about 15 hours after the Silk Road suspect, Ross Ulbricht, was arrested in San Francisco. And then more transactions start following after that. So pretty much everyone's assumed that this account is the FBI, because the amount of Bitcoins that are in there and when all the transfers started happening to it, they're pretty sure that. So people started donating tiny amounts of Bitcoin so they could comment on it. And I actually went on the blockchain website and looked at it when Swap pointed it out to me, because he thought it was hilarious too. And somebody had Rickrolled the entire front page. I mean,
that is awesome. The sad part is
people are spending money. I mean, it's a tiny amount of money, but they're spending money to do this crap.
Oh, yeah, and you know, they're messing with the FBI.
It's 35 you know, like, cents for a practical joke against the federal government. God, I might buy Bitcoin just to do that.
Yeah, but you got to remember, too, like, every transaction that happens on Bitcoin is public. And by sending something to them, that address that you're using is now being public. And the FBI is aware that you are messing with them with that address.
So what you do is you go to a convenience store, you buy a Visa gift card for whatever amount, you then go to a coffee shop, boot up Puppy Linux on your laptop, use their free Wi-Fi to open up a Bitcoin wallet, put how much ever's on your Visa gift card into that wallet, and then send hilarious messages to an FBI agent who may or may not be reading any of these emails that they're getting.
I don't think they're reading them.
Wouldn't you?
I'd be almost positive that they're not reading them.
I'm fairly certain they're not, but I'm just going to assume they are if I ever do this for the hilarity factor of it.
Go ahead, are you?
I reckon one of them would be. You know? I'm pretty sure if you're in the computer crimes division, you're going to have a passing interest in this.
You might just think it's funny. I could see somebody from the FBI reposting this stuff to 4chan. Here's my top 10 favorite emails of the week from my Bitcoin wallet.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised that somebody in the FBI knows what 4chan is.
I wouldn't.
Oh, really? You'd be surprised?
Yeah, I'm assuming most of them are actively avoiding it, sort of like, you know, the way we avoid Meat Spin or Tub Girl.
Why would you? I'm surfing the chan now.
Well, I'm thinking of just putting Meat Spin and Tub Girl at the end of random links I post in our TeamSpeak server now.
You're an ass.
So, hey guys, check this out.
Especially if you can format it right so you don't realize what you're clicking on until it's too late. Like, hey, check out this Wikipedia article somebody wrote about you. And it's like, you know, one of those shortened URLs. I really shouldn't explain how to do that shit to Madman.
No, what's great is you've already explained it. I just have to go into the archives and listen.
Oh, fuck.
I will use your kung fu against you.
God, speaking of that.
Welcome to the ban list.
What were you going to say, are you?
I said, welcome to the ban list, man. That's it.
Just never click on a shortened link from Madman. We're just going to say that one right out. Okay. For Digital Dojo, what I have tonight is kind of cool. It's an older post on Iron Geek's site. He has a nice little guide to build a black throw box out of a Raspi. Now, what a black throw is it's a computer that you would physically leave on somebody else's network with the intention of hacking into their network later through this little computer. And so what he's got is he's got a little guide to setting up I2P on a Raspi so that it beacons out and you can connect back into it and then use the Raspi to pivot into the network and hack the network. But as much fun as that is, I'm thinking this thing's just useful for setting up an ICP router on your Raspi. So he's got really good instructions of how to get I2P up and running on a Raspi. And then he's got a few more steps to turn it into the Black Throw or Slartifast, I believe is what he calls it. There's Sparkcast. I don't know that language. I'm American. Sorry. Yeah, I'm not good at other languages, as my reading of names in this show for the past however many years should prove. So, but I2P is a cool one to use for this kind of a tunnel because it has the nice side effect of getting around a whole lot of your average NAT setups. So, you know, if you want to build a black throw, cool. I mean, it's a good way to do it. Raspi is a good little candidate for that because it's a fairly decent machine, especially when you're hitting it remotely. And they're not crazy expensive. You can get them on Amazon, $40-$50. But, you know, just be aware with the Black Throw, you're likely not getting the thing back. So, you know, it's a whole thing where you tape a computer under a desk and then use it to connect back into the network later, or, you know, hide it in the potted plant, or, you know, the toilet, whatever. I don't know.
But as we were saying before, Morps, make sure it's clean too.
Yeah.
No serial numbers on anything. Don't purchase it in your state. Purchase it with cash.
Preferably, you know how Madman was talking about getting these Bitcoins? You. That's how you want to order the Raspberry you're going to use for this.
Yeah.
So, but, or you can just set up I2P on the Raspberry and use the Raspberry's little router for getting onto I2P. So, again, nice little guide. Quick link there. It's actually not that hard to find on the site. You just go to Iron Geek and search for Raspberry. I'm sure you'll find it. So, that's really pretty much all I've got. We're over our hour here, so listen to the stream. We're always working on it, and I've noticed we've had more listeners on the stream lately, which is awesome. Although we looked at the one, it looked like we had one guy who was connected four times. I don't know what was up with that, but anyways, it looks like we've got more listeners anyways, and that's cool too. So, of course, Pure Decking every Thursday, Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays, which I understand started back up again this week. I wasn't on that. Are you? How'd that go?
Shoot the Noise. I don't think we did it this week. We did it last week.
Oh, we did it last week. Okay.
Or either that or I've... Yeah, I think we were meant to do it this week, but we've sort of been skipping them if it's a rather slow news week.
Fair enough. So,
no one wanted to talk about the debt ceiling debates again?
Oh, man, we've done it to death. It's almost like climate change, you know, there's... Nobody really wants to talk about it anymore. It's there. You can't do anything about it. Depending on how this truckers thing goes, we'll talk about that next week and possibly look into Boko Haram, the craziest terrorist group out there.
Nice.
Or freedom fighter, depending on which side of the fence you sit.
We're some missing dialogues on Tuesdays, IHN on Saturdays. Let's Get Drunk is on every other Friday. And then on the Fridays, we're not doing Let's Get Drunk. Lore does drunken anime show.
Yeah.
What's it? No, he's got a name for that show.
Plots, I think.
Watch drunken it for the plots. Drunken anime plot. That's it.
Yeah, that's
anime
it.
Plot.
You need to harden up, man. I do the drunken show every night.
He's going to be mad at us for flubbing the name, but it's Drunken Anime Plot. And my understanding is they watch various perverted anime and drink every time there's a panty shot. So
they'll be dead in a month.
Depending on the anime, they'll be dead in an episode.
So that, you know, I'm going to catch up on that one. Just some of the stuff we've been running lately, I haven't had a good chance to do that. That's on my list of stuff I need to catch up on. I also need to catch up on... I've lost my tabs. I need my other Firefox window. Shit. I've been meaning to catch up on Shut Up and Write as well. One of our guys in the IRC does that, and I've been meaning to listen to that. So, yeah,
I enjoyed it. Great show, man.
Awesome.
Keep them up.
You know, when I get into listening, I might look at putting some of them on the stream or something. That'd be kind of fun, too. So, anyways, of course, hit up the Galaxy 15 Radio site, the Twitter handle, the Galaxy 15 Radio Sim on OS Grid, the feedback forum, the subreddit, the RC channel, telepathically sending weird pictures to Big. I'm running out of other ways to get a hold of us, but I'm sure I'm missing a few.
Through the NSA. Drop them a line,
when you send your email, just, you know, copy it to the NSA and they'll make sure we get it. And you know what? I'm stalling here because I forgot to pick music to close the show out with. So I'm just going to pick the next thing in the queue here.
Take it away, Madman.
What, on stalling?
Oh, with the music.
Randomly start singing into the mic, yes. No, yeah, it's not going to happen this week.
How about this? How about we just play some Body Call Electro Havoc here?